I got to give my air here, all right? I'm Les. I'm an alcoholic, an addict. How's everybody tonight? Good? All right. What a deal, huh? Really didn't know where I was going when I came, you know. Telling some of the guys, I didn't even know that it was called New Beginnings or anything, but I surely liked that title, you know. Been about my life in sobriety, that's for sure. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to tell the truth. That's hard to do, ain't it? Before Alcoholics Anonymous, I was under the influence of alcohol, obviously. And just as importantly, I was under the influence of me. And under the influence of me, I didn't tell the truth. So I'm sure you can relate to that. So I want to tell the truth before I start this story tonight. You know, I do what I normally do, I guess. I want to toughen up, you know. I told my story in Indiana. There's a part of my story I'm going to share with you tonight that I do really well with it. And I realized in this beautiful place out here, and in all honesty, I didn't think about it on the plane, that my wife died 16 years ago this week, and here I'm in this beautiful place, you know. And I'm pretty good with it, you know. I work through a lot of that grief, working with a sponsor and working the 12 steps and being in the legacies, Unity Service and Recovery, you know. But I still carry that. So I guess what I'm trying to say, if I'm authentic tonight and get a little emotional, you understand, okay? So that's on my heart. I feel that. You know, I didn't start drinking because I had problems. I had problems because I drank. Okay? I was surrounded by love when I was a little boy. And if you look at me real close, you can probably imagine what I looked like. I was a little blonde-headed boy, you know. Didn't want to hurt anybody. Really always... I had a good heart when I was a little boy. And I was like any other little boy, you know. I loved sports. I loved athletes. Or I loved being an athlete. And I was the oldest son of six children. And I got four sisters and I got a kid brother. And fortunately for them, I don't know, fortunately that they didn't have to experience what I experienced. But in the end, you know, 20-some years later, it's been the greatest gift and the greatest asset of my life. See, my sisters and my kid brother, my mother and my father, they didn't have the allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And in all honesty, when I hit that first fine wine that I hit, you know, I liked Ripple. Even Ballet High. Anybody ever drink any Ballet High? Richard's Wild Irish Rose. You know, even when I hit that, I hit it really just because it was in the neighborhood, you know. But I'll go back to being a little boy. I had grandparents. I had aunts. I had uncles. I had family all around me, man. I can remember my mother kissing me almost every night. And I can't remember a week her not telling me she didn't love me. And I was born with a gift that ended up, the skills I needed for the gift probably ended up being a detriment, and I didn't know that till I did a real searching and fearless moral inventory. But the gift I had was baseball. Kind of a funny way to start your AA story out, but it's the truth. I know I don't look like it. But in those days, I was a true athlete. I was with Levitt Boys Club, and I was on the city leagues, and I was on the little leagues, and people watched me, you know, and I didn't know they watched me. And What they didn't know is when they weren't around and weren't looking, you know, I was in the parking lot and I'd paint these boxes on walls with an X, you know, and even by myself till 7, 8 o'clock at night, my mother would have to come down there and get me and say, come on home, son, because I'd throw that ball and throw the ball and throw the ball and throw the ball. And I had a lot of tenacity. I didn't even know that word till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this right arm, for whatever reason, it got gifted. It got gifted to the point that before I had my first fine wine, everybody in the neighborhood would come and see me. Little boy, I was throwing the ball 40-some miles an hour. That ain't bad, is it? For a little guy, and by the time I was probably in my early teens, I was throwing at high 70s, low 80s. And, you know, the neighbors would come, my granddad would come, my granny'd come, my mother, father, sisters, brothers, you know, and they'd watch me. And I didn't care so much about who was in the stand, I can tell you this tonight. I cared that they were there. And I cared that that they were proud of me. And, you know, I did so well that I took that little league team with the team. You know, it's kind of like the team I have tonight. You know, without you, I couldn't be here. Without them, I couldn't have accomplished that. You know, it kind of went full circle, didn't it? But anyway, we went to the World Series. We lost by a couple games, but I was always proud of that, you know. And for whatever reason, that night that they offered me that wine, you know, it went down real smooth. Anybody ever been there? And I didn't know that my mother's side's from Tennessee, and I really didn't know my family in Tennessee as well as my family in Chicago, you know. And I had a granddad that was a chronic alcoholic. And when I say chronic, I'm talking chronic. I didn't know that till years later, you know. Chronic is where your liver swells up and you get cirrhosis and you get alcoholic hepatitis and yellow jaundice. And chronic is where you drink away everybody you love and you do things that are hideous. And I didn't know that night that I ignited something in me that was going to take me places I truly, truly never thought in my whole childhood I would go. And, you know, if I was to be honest and keep it simple, you know, alcohol turned me into a monster. That allergy, that craving to drink alcohol despite what happened, you know, the personality changes, the drinking and knowing that I really truly didn't have the ability to stop. And I walk in taverns, you know, and I'd order drinks, and I'd go places and I'd order drinks, man, and all of a sudden it was 5, 6, 8 hours later, you know, and I didn't remember anything, you know. And in the beginning, you know, I started recognizing that something was wrong, but you know, when I got to that point where I started blacking out and I started losing control, and I knew when you weren't around and you weren't looking, I needed a drink. You know, I needed a drink. But before that, you know, before it started to progress a little, I chased the beginning, you know. I don't know if any of you ever done that, you know. I chased 1972, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Black Sabbath, Motown, concerts, you know. I chased Creedence Clearwater Revival and smoking them big, you know, what I call, which I guess what you call in California, them big burritos, you know. And I started getting introduced to all kinds of things, you know what I'm saying? And it didn't matter, you know, if I had alcohol in me and you thought it worked, man, I'd do it with you. And, you know, I don't remember how old I was. I wish I could pinpoint that. I remember being in that place, and my story got a little drugs in it. I don't know if anybody got that problem, but I remember taking my first shot, you know, and In Chicago, there was just a lot of people, man, doing drugs, and it was a culture. It was a way of life. It wasn't like it is today. You know, today there's a war on drugs, and back then it was, would you like to have a drug, you know, would you like to get high? It was kind of the tail end of the hippie thing, you know. But we had a lot of fun, you know, and crazy things happened, you know. I was a happy drunk too, but you know, my friends in those early days before I started progressing and they started moving in different directions and I went down the path I'm about to tell you about, you know, they'd do things to me because I'd drink a quart of whiskey and or I'd do a bunch of preluding or crank or whatever and drink a quart or two of whiskey and I'd pass out and they'd pull my pants down and put me out in the front yard on a lawn chair, you know, and pull my shirt up over my head and I'd wake up out there naked, you know, and you know, it was fun, you know, it was just it was just playing and I'd always look down and say, oh boy, I hope they didn't see that, you know. Neighbors would drive by, you know. But you know, we had a good time, you know, and you know, the concerts, and I got into a little gambling. Anybody ever do that, you know? I had an uncle on the other side of the family nobody liked, and he run these gambling houses, and he said, son, I'll give you a couple of percent of the pot if you come and just watch the pot and watch the house. And, you know, I'd sit up there and make me $100, $200 in an evening and have that little bar over there he had and drink and sneak outside and smoke me some weed and do a little drugs. And all that was just fun. It was exciting. And the thing that I guess I'm leaving out and I don't want to leave out is before everything got really crazy, I mean, I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous make it sound, and I'm sure we have members in Alcoholics Anonymous from the very first time they ever picked up, it was bad. But I can't say that. I didn't know that the symptoms of alcoholism were bad because I truly never thought I was an alcoholic. I didn't know because I had intoxicated induced amnesia, and I learned that one from a doctor in AA. I said, what is that? He said, that's a blackout. This is a fancy word, way of saying it. Well, hell, I lived in those, but, you know, I was also, like I told you, I was an athlete. I was drinking wine, smoking weed, doing acid, and doing it all, And I was a straight A student in Chicago. We got a Chicago guy in here. He's a little younger than I am, but you know, they had U, unsatisfactory, F, fair, G was good, and E was excellent. And there wasn't too many report cards I didn't bring home that weren't E's. And, you know, as this thing, as the party continued, you know, in the probably 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, you know, in those years, it was just a way of life. It was just waking up here and waking up there. And, you know, one thing led to another. To make a long story short, I got into these shots. And when I say shots, I'd miss a lot, you know. And I'd get these yellow and green abscesses on my arms. Anybody ever been there? Yeah. And I drink a lot of liquor. And then I come to believe that, or I come to realize that I could, you know, do a lot of crank, do a lot of speed. And the more crank and the more speed I could do, I could go down on Rush Street in Chicago. Anybody ever been there? No? I don't know how many blocks you have. I don't know how many blocks of bars and nightclubs there are, but there's a few, ain't it? And we'd shoot up a bunch of dope, man, and start on one corner and try to make it down the block. And, I mean, one shot in each bar all the way down. And, you know, by the time I got down there, I was insane, all right? And I'd stay up on these runs 3 and 4 days, you know. And alcohol and drugs was slowly doing to me what I surely didn't know it could do to me. It was slowly taking my life. It was becoming my life. It was becoming a way of life. And I hadn't given myself a chance. You know, I hadn't given myself a chance. I dropped out of school. I started moving in directions that aren't important. And here tonight, I like to say what my first sponsor told me to always say is, one is the fifth tradition. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And two is don't share your fifth step in an AA meeting. Okay? But I went on a lot of trips with these guys, okay? And how I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, my last sin is I woke up in a hospital. And prior to that hospital, I had committed a crime about 3.5 years before I hit the hospital. And I didn't mean to do the crime. If you're new, I hope you don't hear that wrong. Because I'm not saying that because I'm rationalizing or not being accountable or responsible for my actions. But the crime I committed wasn't a good crime. And it surely wasn't about being a star athlete. It surely wasn't about being under the influence of love and family. It surely wasn't about being an honor student. It was because I was under the influence of alcohol and me. And I found myself in positions a lot of times before I committed that crime, and I just thought that was normal too, because this little crew I ran with went to Cook County Jail all the time. And I'd find myself in Cook County sometimes 2 days, a day, a week, 30 days, 60 days. They'd let me out, you know, in and out, in and out. Sometimes I'd get out, and my oldest sister, Debbie, would be over at Nyman's Food Store. And I'd walk in there right out of the county jail, man, and I'd grab me a shopping cart, and I'd go down that alcohol aisle, and I'd fill it up with alcohol, and I'd throw whiskey in that cart, and I'd walk up to her counter, and I'd wait and watch, and I'd see there's one or two people, and they'd leave, and I'd slide my cart up there, and she'd look at me, and I'd look at her, and I'd hand her $2.37. And she knew. You know that incomprehensible demoralization they talk about? That was the eye contact that I started seeing and feeling. By that time, my family knew there was no hiding. The last time I got out of the county jail, I went on a real, real bad run. And my crime happened. And I ended up back in the Cook County Jail. And I was there 4.5 months, and I had a public defender, and I didn't have any visits, and I didn't have anybody there. And I'd like to stand here tonight and tell you, if you're new, the consequences of my drinking got me sober, but I can tell you tonight, the consequences didn't get me sober. What got me sober was loneliness. Anyway, I went before the judge, and like most times, the judge had the right guy, me. And what he didn't know is, right before I went to him, man, I'd been on this spiral. I was falling apart. I was going down, and nobody knew it, and I knew the party was over, and I was chasing the beginning. And without giving you a huge drunkalogue, I knew I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew when they put me in that county jail all those times before, and now I can tell you exactly how many times since I applied for a pardon. I was in the county jail 17 times. I had 26 misdemeanors and 3 felonies, 2 that I beat and 1 I went to jail for. And this time, the judge didn't play. He said, son, you've been in and out of this court and you've been in and out of these jails for a long time. And I don't know what it was about the late 70s, but they didn't offer a whole lot of AA. Did you experience that? They didn't even offer treatment. Not to say I wanted treatment. I wasn't an alcoholic. But anyway, he went ahead and sent me to jail. And the whole time I was in jail, 27 months, I didn't get a visit. Nobody came. And that was my true signal. See, I know what it's like to walk around either in Alcoholics Anonymous or in an institution under the influence of me. And I didn't know till I met you that that's what we call in bondage to me. And the whole time I did that time in that institution, I did 13 months in Joliet. Some of you may have heard of that, maximum security. And I did 4.5 months in the county, and I did 9.5 months in Vandalia. The whole time, I would lay there at night. Not every night, but a lot of nights. And I'd put a towel around my eyes because I never shut those lights off. And I'd say to myself, man, this isn't how it was supposed to be. And the more that I lived in that jail, the more I realized just what exactly what I had become. And the word alcoholic wasn't in it. I'd become a failure and a loser. And on the other side of town, not too far from Joliet, I had a mother who was an RN. I had a father that was an engineer. I had two sisters getting married. I had a brother working for the newspaper, and I had two sisters in school, and their oldest son was in maximum security, locked down, a prisoner to the state, in bondage to himself, and a drunk. And unfortunately, I didn't know the drunk. Anyway, make a long story short, I did my time, and I can remember right before I was going to the parole board, I walked around in this yard. And by that time, I had image management. You know what that is? You know image management? You know, we slick, hip, and cool. You know that, right? Huh? Long ponytail. I had these guys press my pants. I had my boots polished. I was buffed up a little bit, you know, a lot younger. And I was walking around the yard by myself. And I was telling myself, this is going to change. Got to change. Something's got to get different. And I'd met a lot of guys. They'd done life on the installment plan. See, I can't stand before you tonight with a lot of ego about doing time and hard time because I know I'm not a convict. I did a little stint. I met guys in the joint that'd been there 20 years, five times. I did time with Richard Speck, and I used to look at that cat and say, whoa. I don't know if you know who he was. He was killed all them nurses in Chicago. He's a painter in Joliet and a homosexual. You know, I ran with Aryans and Latin Kings, and before the Black Peystone Rangers became El Rukins, they were Black Peystone in Joliet, and Vice Lords. And sometimes I would ask myself, I wonder how an athlete I mean, I never lived in the projects in three rooms, and they had five mattresses on the floor and nine kids and nothing to eat. But I heard them and I listened. But my family sent me a flag, you know. They sent me a kite, and the kite was, it's over. So I walked that yard and I told myself it's going to change. And I went to the parole board and they paroled me. And here's where it gets interesting. Nobody come and get me, so I made a phone call. Who you expect I call? Yeah, he came. The guy I grew up with came. And while I was in jail, he had tattooed two dice on his forehead and his hair was sticking out like this. I come walking out with a brown paper bag. He had a quart of whiskey and a burrito. And see, always, alcoholism centers in the mind. I thought it was going to change, but I didn't think changing it meant not picking up a drink. I knew I had to quit shooting dope. I didn't have any place to go, so Illinois Department of Corrections put me in a hotel downtown called the Newell Hotel, and it was a dump. Then on the other side of town, there they were, and I knew I couldn't call them, knew I didn't want to call them, knew I was a failure, knew I was a loser. And Terry'd come and get me almost every day, and I was supposed to be looking for a job, and we'd end up in them bars, Cicero, all through the neighborhood. And before I knew it, I was right back to where I had started 2.5 years earlier. And I come home, and now I was eating Secanol, Nebutal, Placidils. Anybody ever do those? Yeah. And I drank. And when I say I drank, you know, I drank around the clock, you know. My life was not good. Who I was not good. What I walked with spiritually was hatred, was anger, was resentment, was blame. And I was a victim. I know what you told me when I got here, and I had a hard time believing it, but it's the truth. There are no victims in Alcoholics Anonymous, just volunteers. Well, I volunteered to be a victim out there. See, it was their fault. How'd they turn their back on me? And slowly it got worse and worse and worse. And I come home at night, man, and I turn the light on in that room, man, and I'd see those cockroaches run up the wall. And I was sick. And I was drinking. Anybody ever puked that yellow and green mucus out of their stomach? Anybody? Yeah. One night I walked out of that room and I puked some of that yellow and green mucus up out of my stomach. And some Secanol was in it when it hit the ground. And I reached down in my puke and I ate that Secanol. And the reason I tell you that is I believe that Secanol was put there by God. Because when I reached down, I ate that Secanol and I went back in that room and I did what I know I had to have done, is I took another hit off that bottle. And what I didn't know is in the last 6 or 8 months, I'd been eating way too much Secanol. And I knew I was passing out all the time, and it wasn't until I woke up in that detox that that doctor told me I hadn't been passing out. That doctor told me I'd been overdosing. And that nurse, I woke up in that hospital, you know, and the room was white. It was a county hospital. And it had a crucifix on the wall. And I didn't remember the ambulance. I remember picking up those pills, and I asked the nurse, I said, how'd I get here? And she said, you've been here a little, almost 3 days. And she said, the doctors had to sedate you because you were in withdrawal. And she asked me, she said, do you do barbiturates? And people laugh, you know. When I woke up in that detox room, I had a IV in this arm, and I had an IV going down my nose, and when I looked up at the crucifix, I noticed I was wired, and I felt this strange sensation, and I lifted the sheet, and I had something coming out of my penis. Well, in my mind, I thought the IV was going in my arm, down my nose, and out my penis. You know, and I like to say this because it's true. You know, I dabbled in pharmacology, but I didn't know nothing about that medical profession. When I rang that buzzer, she come in there and grabbed my penis and pulled that tube, and I thought it was all coming out. I let a war whoop out. They could hear 3 halls down, okay? Don't do that, all right? And I always like to remember it. Anyway, this little bitty nurse tells me that they had to detox me. I said, what's that mean? She said, you were drinking a lot of alcohol and you had a lot of Secanol in your body. And have you ever passed out before? Well, hell, how many of us don't pass out, you know? I never asked for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know why? I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I can honestly look at you tonight and tell you I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. When she left the room, I had a memory. That was in May. And about 3.5 months before that, a guy that ran with me and Terry was missing. Nobody could find him. And I banged on his doors at his house 2-3 days, no answers, and finally I knew something was wrong. And he had three little windows in the door. And I punched one of the windows and I opened the door from the outside. And Jerry had stuck a sawed-off shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. And he wasn't the only one. You know, Henry Walden hung himself in the county jail. David and Mike Perry both died. Lots of things were changing in my neighborhood. And when I woke up in that detox, man, and I was stark raving sober, and guess who I was under the influence of? Guess what I was under the influence of? Alcoholism. Drug addiction. Without a physical drink in my body. And that little nurse went and called these guys, you know. And they came over. And I never... they came over, they're 30 years older than me. And they tell me their story. And how they did it is what I want to talk about a little bit tonight, is they told me they were powerless over alcohol and their lives had become unmanageable. You know, and if you're new, you hear that word powerless right away, it's a reaction. You see, a star athlete can't be powerless over anything. I'm coming full circle. Tenacity and willpower is what I lived on. I wasn't going to quit. I wasn't going to stop. You know, one of them said, how many times you walk in a tavern and order a blackout? Well, you know, I never walked in a tavern and ordered anything that I had. Nothing. They told me they were powerless over alcohol and their lives had become unmanageable. And in that moment, ladies and gentlemen, in that moment, I had never had a life other than alcoholism and drug addiction. See, I'm one of the guys, and I always want to say this, to thine own self be true. Not only was I an alcoholic, but I truly was a failure and a loser. Because I'd never had a credit card. I'd never had a bank account. I'd never really had a car. I never had insurance. I never had a dog. I never had a residence that I really called my own. I never paid rent. I shot dope and did things that I won't talk about. And I drank a lot of liquor every day. And I surely wasn't a straight-A student. And my life was totally unmanageable. But more importantly, I was alone. I knew when I left that hospital where I'd go. And they told me about this program, you know. They told me that when I say this program, I'm not talking Alcoholics Anonymous in general. Here's what they told me. They told me about a program of action. They told me about these steps that they took. These steps they took together. They told me about these places they went. They were meetings. And they said, if I came there, and this is genius, and one day at a time I didn't pick up a drink, I might be able to not be so lonely. And I got to tell you, and I forget to mention this, when I was 12-step the first time, I had tears running down both sides of my face because I had identification. Because, you know, I too drank despite my will not to. If the consequences of alcoholism and drug addiction would have got me to Alcoholics Anonymous or sober, if I had had the ability to quit on my own, I would have quit. If the truth were to be known, when I laid in the Newell Hotel, there were 1,000 nights, it seemed, that I would tell myself, it's got to stop. It's got to stop. And I couldn't do it. They told me we could. I got out of that hospital and I started going to meetings, and I met this guy named Dirty Louie. He was an old AA guy. He told me, I don't want you to say nothing. I just want you to listen. He said, be quiet. You don't know nothing about staying sober. One thing you do know in this moment is you're powerless over alcohol and your life would become unmanageable. And this program of action and these steps are what you're going to have to take. And you're going to have to find something much greater than you. And right now, I understand you're angry at everybody, everything, and probably God. Even if you don't believe in God, it's not important. Believe in us. Just come. And I went in this little room, man, and I sat down and I listened to people tell their story. And I listened to the first step. I listened to women tell their stories about how they'd have taxi cabs come to their house and bring them their liquor every day. But more importantly, I'd listen to those blackouts, those attempts at abstinence, the constant, constant inability to stop drinking. The craving and obsession to drink despite their wills not to. And what they were doing is, I could see in you what I couldn't see in me. Louis told me that I had to accept that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. And he told me that I was the only guy that had to sit on the couch, because these first three steps, I could sit over in that chair and do by myself to some degree. But I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I had to concede to my innermost self that I was unmanageable. I had to accept that I was an alcoholic, and I only had to do that one day at a time. Do you still hear that message? He told me, we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we come to, and we come to believe. And he told me, I'm going to take you through these first nine steps, and all I'd like you to do is just do them. And I know nothing about them. I hadn't even read them. I went to that little room for a while. I don't know how long. And I listened, and I listened, and I listened. And as I listened, I fully started to concede to myself what the problem was, but more importantly now, for the first time in all these years, somebody was offering me a solution. And you know, Louis mentioned that word, you know, that word that I don't like. That psychic change. I changed the psychic change to a hope change. You see, I was getting a little hope that maybe I wasn't such a failure and such a loser. You ever cry in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yeah. Seemed like everything that was ever horrible for me, my videotape, you got a videotape? My videotape was in that little room. Jerry was in that little room. Jail was in that little room. The cockroaches was in that little room. All of my bottom was in the little room. He said, we come to, and we come to believe. And I'll never forget this. I was at his house, and he handed me this little card, and he said, I want you to read this. But before you read it, I want you to just get down on your knees with me and read it. He handed me this little card. And he said, I noticed that you got some hope. Now I want to take you into sobriety. And he said, I'm not going to waste your time. You know, I hear people say they took a step a year and, you know, a step every 6 months and, you know, all this bullshit, you know. Them guys told me, man, you know, we'll meet you back in detox, you know. You don't do this, all right? And there wasn't nothing that I had before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I really want back. Nothing. The only thing I wanted back was those memories. Those memories before I hit that ripple. Those memories of that love. those memories of being a decent man. Anyway, I got down and I read it, and it was the third step prayer. You ever read it? And you know, I had a moment. I had a God shot. I had just a little clarity. I was starting to get some hope, and all of a sudden, saying that gave me just a little more hope. And it helped me to realize that when I didn't have a drink and I didn't have a drug in my body, I was in bondage to me. And I remember asking him this before I even understood 6 and 7. I said, well, what does it really mean to be in bondage to me? He said, you're under the influence of all your defects of character. Do y'all know what the defects of character are? Huh? You know, when you're looking good in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're looking bad. When you think you're looking bad in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're telling the truth, you're looking good. See, there ain't no image management in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know, alcohol is but a symptom of our illness. Bottles are but symbols, and the problem is us. And we're real similar in nature, Les. When we don't have a drinking drug in our body, we're in recovery from who? From me. And he said, we all need something greater than ourselves. And he said, I don't expect that a guy like you, who's real similar to a guy like me, will find this power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous until you complete the ninth step. He said, but I want you to do something. I want you to work on saying this prayer every day. I want you to attend a meeting every day. I want you to stay real close. I want you to call me. And I want you to come to my house. I got something for you. And when I went to his house, guess what he had for me? He had a four-column inventory sitting on the table on fear, resentment, and sex. We don't want to mention that, do we? That's sex. And he says, I want you to list your fears one at a time. Then I want you to go to the second column and list your cause one at a time. What's the cause of the fear? I want you to go to the third column and list the effect of your life and to others. And I want you to go to the fourth column. And for the first time in your life, Les, we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion. I want you to break some of them. What's your part in all your fear? What's your part in all your resentments? And what's your part in all your relationships? Well, you know, that didn't sound too good. I got to say this. I've heard Keith and other guys say it because, man, I thought, holy shit. My attorneys told me don't ever write this shit, all right? I mean, really? And then go tell somebody? I mean, you're talking about me practicing a principle that I didn't have yet. I had deceit. I had deviousness. I was a con. I'm a con artist. I'm a liar. I'm a thief. I didn't have the principle of trust, forgiveness, love, hope, service. I didn't have that. But I knew I didn't want anything I had before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wrote that inventory. I went to him, and I shared my inventory with him. And while I was sharing my inventory with him, he was writing. What do you suppose that did for me? It made me a little nervous having somebody write while I was sharing my inventory. I said, what are you writing, man? He said, oh, I'm writing your defects. I know you're still too slick, hip, and cool, but we'll get to that next. Anyway, I shared my inventory, man, and he explained to me what my defects were, and I became entirely ready to have God remove the defects of character, just the defects of character that would get in the way of me accepting my sobriety that day. And I know there's controversy when I say this. I only do this once a year. I ain't a circuit speaker, and that's fine. But he said, Les, every time you're going to con, every time you're going to lie, every time you're going to run your bullshit, I want you to humbly ask God to remove that shortcoming. And I want you to take some time, and I want you to look at your defects, and I want you to look at what you're under the influence of in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you ain't under the influence of a drug or a drink today. This is what you're under the influence of. This. This is what will get you drunk. And God knows we've seen the parade come through Alcoholics Anonymous doing image management. Right? Pretending. Trying to look good. Trying to sound good. Quoting a book. Not doing the work. You know, he told me, you can set an AA on moss grows on the west side of your ass, son. You're going to get drunk. The truth. Isn't it the truth? I can sit in these meetings and not be in recovery from me and sound good. Anyway, I looked at them defects and I didn't like none of them. He said, I want you to take this inventory before you destroy it, and I want you to make a list. I said, a list? He said, well, I made your first list. I said, what is it? Yeah, well, here's your defects. Now I want you to make a list of who, what amends you've made, who you've hurt. I had 72 people on that first list. 72. And the only reason I had 72 is I had broken some of my delusions. Because a lot of times those people were probably more wrong than I was, and he told me, don't pay no attention to that. I don't care how much you hate them. If they're 99% wrong and you're one, you're in it. They belong on your list. So I wrote my list. And you know, I did all this the first year I was sober, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't sit in Alcoholics Anonymous and talk. As a matter of fact, I didn't do a whole lot of talking other than to him. Because I didn't have nothing to talk about. What was I going to tell you? I could have stood up here tonight and wasted your time and told you year for year what happened. But I didn't have a solution. I couldn't live with me. And I still didn't like me. He said, you know, when we get to this ninth step, we got to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. We got to leave our big book. We got to leave our sponsors. We got to leave the meeting. We got to get in a car if we got a car. We got to get in a plane. We got to get on a bus. We got to get on a train. We got to get in a taxi, or we got to walk. And we make these amends. So I made a lot of amends, you know, and right in the middle of all those amends, my sponsor said to me, hey, what about these people? Well, who do you figure he was talking about? You know, I'm still a slick, hip drunk. You know, I wanted to leave the last ones for last. See, I hadn't seen my family in 4 to 5 years. 4 to 5 years. I hadn't seen them. So he said, pick one of them. And I thought I was smart, you know. I'm going to pick the easy one. I'm going to call my granny. I know, don't say it. I don't look too smart either, do I? So I call her up and I say, listen, I'm alive. You mind if I come and see you? There's some things I want to tell you. So I had a 1976 Gremlin Hornet with a hole in the floorboard. Oh, I didn't have the benefits I have tonight. I got a new car tonight. I'll get to that. I threw the mat on the floor so the snow and the wind didn't blow up in my face, and the defroster worked sometimes, you know. And I drove down there. She was in the old folks' home. And she knew I'd been in prison. She didn't know about the hotel. She didn't know about parole. She didn't know about all the stuff that had happened after. She didn't know I was in a hospital with tubes in me, detoxing in a coma, under sedation. She didn't know any of that. She didn't even know what I did to her. Louis said, when you make direct amends, you make direct amends as long as you don't injure anybody else. If it injures you, good. He said, the whole program, Alcoholics Anonymous, is really about ego deflation and having a power greater than yourself, and you got a lot of work to do, son. Anyway, I went down there, you know, and I got on the elevator, and I went to a door, and, you know, I'm like a lot of guys, and I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to know, and I've been in probably meetings in most of the states in the United States, that I haven't seen some of the things I know men have seen, but I've seen my share. Even jail, I seen some things I'd never mention in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But nothing scared me more than to face her. And I didn't even know I had that fear till I got to her door. I was like guarded till I got there. And I knocked on the door. She opens the door, and what do you think she does? I thought she was going to slap me or tell me to leave when she finally seen me. She grabs me and hugs me and tells me how much she loved me. And I'm still guarded. And what my home group didn't know, what nobody knows, and I love to tell people this, is my granny never missed a baseball game. My granny would make me root beer floats. My granny combed my hair. My granny, I was her firstborn grandson. She loved me. She didn't know I had an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. She didn't know that I had a craving and an obsession to drink despite my will not to, and her little star athlete had destroyed most of his life. But I told her something that she didn't know, and I just knew I was in trouble. I sat down on the couch with her and I said, Granny, I got to tell you these things. I'm in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and you need to know I'm doing this step. They sent me, this old man sent me. It's called a ninth step, and there's some things I did to you you don't know, but I'm willing to make my side of the street right. And Louis told me, don't go down there telling them people you're sorry. You go down there and tell them you won't do it again today. I said, listen, when Grandpa died, I used to break in your house and crawl in your window, and I'd steal your money, and I'd steal your pills. And I'd lie to you all the time. And I went on my amends. And I said, I want to make it right with you. And she starts crying. I hadn't seen her in, I think, 5 years. I'm under a year sober, working a ninth step, and I'm thinking, man, why did they send me here to hurt my family? It's my grandmother. She made root beer floats for me. She said, I ain't crying because you stole my money and my pills, broke in my home. She said, I'm crying because you're turning out to be the kind of man I always wanted you to be. Remember I told you I was guarding? The ice broke. It melted. And for the first time in a long time, I cried. And when I say cry, I don't know if any of you remember, when your grandmother holds you, it's a special thing. And when she held me, I sobbed. And, you know, you couldn't have given me that. You. Dirty Louie couldn't have given me that. Big Book couldn't have given me that. 164 pages couldn't have given me that. The ninth step gave me that. And my grandmother. She helped me heal. And she was the first family member I engaged after all those years. And when I left, two things happened to me. One, for the first time, I started feeling like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that wasn't full of shit. Because I'm doing the work. Nobody could tell me I wasn't. I just sobbed. I got real. I got honest. I got authentic. To thine own self be true. I got real with who I am and what I am. And I looked myself squarely in the face. And I realized. I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't about staying sick. It was about getting well. And you know, I read in that little thing they got in the big book, that little one sentence, they said sometimes we get rocketed into the fourth dimension. I think I got there then. Just for a moment. And when I went back to my home group and I told my home group what I did, I honestly, for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, truly felt like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, it wasn't a few days later my phone started ringing. God works. I went to my mother's house drunk before all this ever happened, and her husband punched me. I broke his collarbones with his toolbox. When he hit the ground, he was 25, 30 years older than me. I stomped him. I did hideous things to my family. My mother called me and said, "Son, I want to see you." And then the phone started ringing more. And see what that old woman did? She became God's messenger. She called them and said, "That boy's trying to heal. He's trying to change." And she was our elder. And they embraced me. And they held me. And I made my amends with each of them one at a time. And I was so sorry in my heart because I'd missed their children being born. I'd never met my nieces and nephews. And I didn't cop out, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't play victim with them. I stayed accountable and I stayed responsible and I didn't make any excuses about being a recovering alcoholic. I didn't go there and tell them I'll never do it again. I said, "Listen, I don't ever want to do that to you again. And all I got to do is live my life one day at a time." That amend spun off into a new way of life. Louis said, "It's time." He said, "You want to stay a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to get in service." He said, "Guess what? The resume you built before you came to Alcoholics Anonymous is now your strength. It's your asset. And every mile of bad road or every page in the paragraphs are meant to help somebody else. And every time you do help somebody else, I want you to remember the one guy that you'll always carry for the rest of your life." And believe it or not, he had one. And that was Jerry. Because Jerry never got to stand behind a podium and tell you what happened. He never heard our message one time. He blew his head off. In Alcoholics Anonymous, a few years in the service, man, I was working the steps. Got me a job, got me a credit card. Did you ever get one of those? Bought me a little newer car. Got me an apartment with no cockroaches. Went to the meetings, and I don't want to leave this out. Met a guy and helped start a sober motorcycle club called the Outcast Motorcycle Club. It's in Kenosha, Wisconsin, Chicago, and Dayton, Ohio. Going to my meetings, you know, and, you know, it's kind of sad to say, but it really isn't. You know, I thought I was in love a couple hundred times before I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was over 30 years old before I understood love. Maybe I was over 30 years old before I could experience love with a woman, real love. You know, real love, where you give and not take, where you don't lie, you know what I mean? Where you open, where you share your heart, you know. You show them. It's who I am. Her name was Karen. a nutter in Alcoholics Anonymous. And first night I seen her, you know, and God knows we see a lot of men and women. I don't know what that was, you know. I know what it became. It became love. But the first time I laid eyes on her, I had a sparkle. And I dated her for a couple of years, and I knew she was a juvenile diabetic. Didn't bother me. She took insulin. She played tennis. And she was in good condition. We got married, had a big AA wedding, you know, 300-400 people came, you know. I had it at the Holodome, one of those Holiday Inn deals. You ever see those? Wasn't no cockroaches there either. In my eyes, she was absolutely everything that I could ever want in a woman. A couple of years into our marriage, she got sick. And I watched her die for 19 months. And I admitted to her hospital a bunch of times. Took her to Mayo, took her to Chicago, and took her to Milwaukee, you know, wherever you could go. And she died 5 days before Christmas. And, you know, I don't tell you that for you to feel bad or have sympathy. I tell you because there's 1,000 excuses to drink and there's never a good reason. And I can tell you, how could a guy like me, you know, I got a videotape when I say that. Part of that videotape you can't see. That puked yellow and green mucus out of his stomach. That picked pills up out of his puke. That lived in a cockroach-infested hotel. That walked around in yards of institutions in bondage to himself and under the influence himself. How could a guy like that even hold somebody's hand every day and watch him die? You know, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are new, there's 1,000 excuses to drink and there ain't a good reason. And, you know, a lot of us hurt and we try to hide it. You know, I read 100 times, 1,000 times. I heard it said that many times. That all the most difficult things that'll ever happen to me in my sobriety or before my sobriety become my strength. And everything that ever happens always happens because it helps me to be in service that much more to the alcoholic or now in my life to people that aren't alcoholic. Because I can be in service anywhere. I choose here, of course. Right after my wife died, I got a call. My mother was killed in a fatal car accident. A couple of months before she died in the car accident, I had spent the whole night with my mother. And, you know, that wasn't pre-planned. It almost sends shivers up and down my spine when I tell you that because my mother and me never spent the whole night together. But for the first time in my life and her life, she told me who she was as a woman, as a person. And, you know, she started to do that. You know how they are. She started to say to me, you know, Les, out of all my children, you've carried the most crosses. You've bared a lot of burden. You've been through more than any of my other children. And I'm so sorry your wife died. And I had to remember what you taught me. And I looked at her and I said, you know, nothing hurts me as bad in my entire life. And when I came to AA, I want to back up. When Karen was dying and when she died, I didn't come here and look good. Did you hear me? When you think you're looking good, you're looking bad. When I think I'm pretending, I'm wrong. True sobriety is being authentic. It's being real. And AA is the language of the heart. It is an action spiritual program. And I told my mother, I said, Mom, everything that's happened in my life is to help somebody else. And I'll miss Karen till I die. Probably the last thought I'll ever have is her. I know that. And we made this connection. And then I get that call. And my family calls me. I'm the oldest son. So we need your help. What do you think of that? And I go down there and we have a wake and there's all these people. I don't know none of them. And I'm grieving hard. I'm grieving hard, okay? I just lost my wife and now I lost my mother that I loved. I love my mother with all my heart. And I'm standing in line. And I love that God put this in my life. This nurse walks up to me and said, are you Les? And I said, yeah, I'm Les. She said, I worked with your mother for a long time. And I want you to know your mother was so proud of you. She loved you so much. And God gave me a full circle. I didn't feel it in that moment, but tonight I know it to be true. God took me full circle. Because had I not left Alcoholics Anonymous and just sat here and let moss grow on the west side of my ass, had I not left Alcoholics Anonymous and made the ninth step with my mother and developed a relationship with her for 7 or 8 years before her death, I wouldn't have received that. And you know, I really believe this when I say this to you. I'm still learning and I'm still growing. But a lot of what's happened to me to heal me and for me to live in sobriety has happened out of the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's happened one-on-one with the drunks, with my family, with the people I love. I woke up one morning, got to tell you this, there's 1,000 excuses to drink, but there's never a good reason. If you're new, I hope you hear me. I was sick. And I knew something was wrong. I was physically sick. And I always forget to leave this out, and God's putting it in my mind right now, because I ain't scripted, I'm just telling you what happened, okay? I went to Emory Hospital and they diagnosed me in the later stages of prostate cancer. And I had met a woman several years before and we had a daughter. She wanted to have an abortion. And I said, no, I'll be a father. Anyway, I went to Emory, and I got radiation. And I lost 40-some pounds. And I'd leave Emory, and I'd throw up on the sidewalk. And I'd go home. And I never not picked my daughter. And I told her, no matter what happens in this life, I'll love her. I'm her father. And I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous saying that. Because, see, none of my bondage had ever been unleashed on that little girl. I went through the treatments thinking I was going to die. I went to all my friends and I told them, if I don't make it, I thank you. and I got a lot of friends. And I didn't have one. Eighteen months later, they told me that I wasn't going to die. And 5 years later, they told me I was cancer-free. And you know, I didn't pick up a drink of liquor. And I didn't whine. And I went to meetings. And I went to North Chicago VA, and I went to Atlanta, and I went to the halfway houses, and I continued to sponsor the men in my life, and I continued to 12-step them, because I knew 12-stepping them, I was 12-stepping me. Do you hear me? And I didn't tell them nothing about my opinion on anything. I gave them the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know something? I emerged from that nightmare. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Today, today I know if life was fair. I was telling Chris, everybody always says, oh, they'll die. I don't care about death. You die, you don't know you're gone. What you gonna do, scare me with that? You know, to me, it's living with the craving and obsession with yellow and green abscesses up and down my arms. It's living with cockroaches. It's doing life on the installment plan or doing life. It's living on the road. Maybe it'd take me there. There isn't a promise that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous I haven't received. And if you stub your toe, don't drink. If you have a bad day, don't drink. If somebody dies, don't drink. Today. One day at a time, we don't drink. And one day at a time, I've rebuilt my life. And I've rebuilt my life with you, not me. You wouldn't believe it. I own a townhome. I got a house. I own a business. I got a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I know that I always got to come here and report. I never in 25 years have strayed away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have lived some real painful days. But I got to say this. I've lived more days with a whole lot more happiness than I ever had pain. And I share the pain with you because I know you identify with it, and I know if you're new, you need to hear it one more time. There's 1,000 excuses to drink, but there ain't a good reason. God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself, and the greatest gift that I ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous is I have a God in my life today. God walked in this room tonight, not me. I followed. I'm one of his kids and one of his soldiers. When I go to Atlanta Federal or the Atlanta Men's Mission, when I go to the county jails, when I sit with that drunk that's drunk and I tell him my resume, guess what I'm able to do? Through God, I'm able to touch that man. And everything that I ever thought was bad is good. Ain't that a bitch? Everything I ever thought was difficult, build a whole lot of spiritual muscle, ladies and gentlemen. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love all of you. I see you. I see you. And everything I have because of you. You're my blessing. You're my teachers. And I know today that none of those years that I have will keep me sober. Self-knowledge never will. And I know I have to continue to stay under the third, seventh, and 11th steps. And if I get in bondage to my defects and sobriety, I can become just as big of a fucking mess as I could when I was drunk. Okay? Last thing I'll leave you with. Dirty Louie told me this. By the way, he died September 4th, 1995, and I have another sponsor. I don't shop sponsors. I keep the one I pick. But he said, you know, Les, one of the easiest ways to get through our defects on a daily basis, he said, let spiritual principles dominate them. Ain't that a bitch? I said, Louie, that's too simple. You mean where I'm going to be dishonest, the spiritual principle of just being honest? Yeah, try letting that dominate. Do the opposite, Les, and you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. It ain't always going to be easy, but it'll be better than you ever had. And look at me. I ain't special, and I know some of you won't like this. Keith, I honor you. But I have such a hard time calling myself a winner. Because I really don't feel like I won anything. I feel like I work for it all. Okay? And this ain't funny. It almost, in my heart, makes me feel like I'm calling Jerry a loser. And when I do this, I bring him here with me. So, if you haven't worked the steps, try it. That is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings won't keep you sober, but you need them. It's a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the traditions are the rules. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, and that's why I have the gift. Thank you. All right.